This interview is made possible by the View Conference, the biggest computer graphics conference in Italy. Our dates for 2022 are from the 16th to the 21st of October. We hope to see you in Italy or online. For more information about View Conference, please visit our website, viewconference.it. Hi, everyone. My name is Marilena Gutierrez. I am the director of the View Conference here in beautiful Turin, Italy. Today, we have Sebastian De Gui. He's the vice president of 3D and immersive at Adobe.
Thank you for having me today. It's always a pleasure. And the list of the previous participants is quite impressive. So I feel honored to be among these people first. And thank you, Maria. And what you're doing with the View and is quite amazing, actually. And so I look forward to coming and visiting you in Turin as soon as possible.
We would love to have you. So why don't you tell us about your early passions and interests and just how you got started on your creative and professional journey?
If we really go back very early on, I've always been interested in many, many things. I kept driving my parents and my mother especially crazy about like the way my room was looking and like the whole mess and everything that I could put my hands on. I tried to play with and look at and understand how it was working. And so my room was really full of musical instruments and computers. And I've been lucky enough so that my parents actually brought back a computer at home, like very in the early 80s. Actually, which was very early. And so it was a Texas Instrument at the time. And then we had an Apple II, Apple IIc, and then an Atari ST, and then a PC, a series of PCs, et cetera, et cetera. But, my very early days, I've been very passionate about many, many things, curious, and from art to science, in fact. And so I know like, I've been like very astonished and like blown away by cinema, especially and movies like I don't know, War Games and Tron and of course Star Wars and this type of movies with a lot of images that were never seen, that hadn't been never seen before, right? Or 2001 and this type of movies and really sci-fi movies and visual effects. So I started like really digging into this aspect of things. And then there is one meeting I want to convey that actually changed a lot of things for me. I was at the high school in the Clermont in the middle of France. And Clermont is famous for its short film festival. And so it's one of the biggest film festival in the world actually. And it's by far the biggest short film festival in the world. And so every year you have like 100,000, 120,000 people like gathering this small city in the center of France last for a week to watch short films. And that's actually incredible. And I remember I was in high school and we had a chance to go to a special session for students. And so I could see all these movies and they were amazing. And there was one actually that actually stayed in my mind, which is Giselle Kerosene. It was made by Jan Koenen, the director of Blueberry and many other movies, and Doberman and that kind of thing. And Jan Koenen actually was somehow ended up in my classroom after that session. And so because our French teacher could invite him and the crew to talk to us like in my classroom, like 30 young people, not young guys obviously, but young people. And so it was crazy actually because I realized, oh, wait a minute. So the movie I've seen, actually I see the people behind it. And so I made the connection that day. And before that, I was not able to make that connection, but I made a connection between actually there are people doing the images, right? And so these people, they look like me, in fact. Like, it's interesting. And I could talk to them, I could ask them like, okay, what is, what do you put in the script? How do you do this and that? So he was explaining, like, he was like actually using his, I don't know, family car and the money he could like get from his uncle or whatever. So it was a very human thing. And so the first time I connected with made a connection between like what I loved in these images and some people, and actually realizing, oh, maybe it's feasible. Actually, maybe I could do that myself. So I started actually developing movies myself. Started like creating a short films, and I started like writing programs to transform, you know, two input videos into an anaglyph, like a stereoscopic video. So I was doing like my room, and I was like, and you have to imagine like where I was living, but it was really the countryside. So I had nothing. So I had to ask my mother to get like a place to buy one magazine about computer games. Anyway, so very early on, I was super passionate about a lot of things, not having access to a lot of things. And then suddenly at high school, realizing, okay, that connection is, it's actually people doing this. So I started to think, okay, maybe I can follow that path myself. So I started doing that on the side and still having like my science studies, mostly science and math. And so I kept doing this, and I ended up like doing a PhD in computer science. But at the same time, I was also writing, doing music and doing movies and doing animation on the side. And then it all like came together at some point during my PhD when I was teaching Softimage 3D. And I realized, oh, wait a minute, like what's in this tool, like the best tool in the industry at the time, what's in this tool for textures? Actually, I could do the same or better with what I was working on in my PhD. So this is when I did the second connection, and it was like, okay, now I'm ready. Now I have something. Let's start a company and make that connection, finalize that connection between art and science, right? That was a big intro.
So that was in 2003 was when you founded Allegorithmic. You completely transformed the whole landscape for texture creation. Can you tell us a little bit about what your vision was for Substance in those early years?
During my PhD, when you do research, you also have, at least where I was in France, you also had to teach. And so because they knew I was passionate about computer graphics and 3D, they told me like, well, we have this new class in Le Puy and like even more remote location in the center of France. And we have this new class, and it's a 3D class, and they need to learn like the 3D tools, the software packages that we can find. And the best package at the time was Softimage 3D. And it was an amazing package, been used on Jurassic Park and more. And basically they told me like, well, we know you like images. So can you teach these guys? So you will be the teacher now. So I was like, okay, well, yes. Okay, if you want, but I didn't know anything about that tool, to be honest. So I was like 1 week ahead. I had like the documentation, and I was reading the books. And I was like, okay. And I tried to convey that as a professor. And so I was really only 1 week ahead, and some of my students were really better than myself than I was actually. But again, when I was doing this, I realized, okay, wait a minute. Like when you do, like you have like the modeling part, you have the animation part, and then you have the rendering part and the animation part. For the rendering, there was this part about like textures, and the textures were created using shaders based on noise functions. And these noise functions, actually, that was very close to what I was working on. And when I was working on my PhD as a computer scientist and an applied mathematician, and so I realized, okay, wait, like the little prototype I'm working on that creates all these random processes using this mathematical approach that is new, so makes of self-similar fractals, self-similar processes, and wavelet representations, so really like advanced technical stuff. I realized, okay, well, what I can generate from this is actually could actually make sense in the computer graphics industry, in this visual effects industry, because in the best tool, what I can find is limited compared to what I can produce. So I was like, okay, well, my first initial idea was to say, well, how do I exploit what I've been working on, like make the connection again, like between science and then into art, and like give more ability for visual effects artists to create more crazy functions and crazy images. And so like the first idea I had at the time was, okay, well, let's do a conference in this field. And then I went for a first conference, and in the room, in the audience, there was somebody from a Buff company, BUF, and which is famous French visual effects house. And the head of R&D then contacted me after the fact and said, well, what you presented is interesting to us, come and discuss. So I went up to Paris, and I presented what I was doing, and he told me that, well, this is really cool, we really like it, but the artists, they don't like procedural approaches because usually it's frozen. You cannot like manipulate it and like edit it and tweak it by hand. You have to input like numbers, it's complicated. And so they want to control it. So can you control your thing? And I was like, no, of course not, you cannot. But I keep that in mind. So I went back to Clermont and completed my PhD. So I celebrated, got drunk, realized that what I wanted to do was really build a company. And so it was like all connections. And so the company and the idea was, okay, let's take what I've been working on, try to make a company out of that, that will produce cool like 3D computer graphics software, and try to push that to visual effects artists. That was the whole idea. And if I want to be super honest, there was zero business plan, zero. There was no business plan. There was no idea more than like producing cool products and cool like software. And I kept in mind like, you know, do you remember this Kai's Power Goo product? Like it was a small product that would generate like crazy textures. And I loved that product. I was like, wow, I could do something like this. And to me, that was amazing. And I thought it would require maybe, two people, like for two years, and then we'd be done, and we'd have fun, and we'd be like used in all these games and movies. Of course, it took like 10 years and dozens of people to get to a point where yes, people start to use it. But that was the original idea. The original idea was really like, okay, I have this connection. It was more about me following a path and a passion than me chasing something, right? It was just a natural path for me of an evolution. Like, okay, I want to create something. I want to be in control of what I'm doing. I want to just like try to do something that really resonates with artists. And if artists like it, they pay for it. If they don't like it, they don't pay for it. It's the most like straightforward like way of saying, well, okay, it's true or not true, right? You cannot fake it. If you don't sell, you don't sell. If you sell, you sell, right? And that's very easy. Like voting with your money is really very powerful. And so that's that was the whole idea. So yeah, I mean, again, long answer to short question, but yeah. Following your passion was mostly it.
This takes me to my next question about how you got acquired by Adobe in 2019 and where that took you. And I read somewhere online that you have described that as your Peter Jackson moment.
Well, okay, it's a big arc because I started the company in 2003, completed my PhD in end of 2001, like 20 years ago, a little bit more than 20 years ago. Then started the company, and then like in 2019, we joined Adobe. So it's a big arc. And in between, we've been working like crazy. It's not always been like easy. Actually, I'm writing some of the chapters, like to keep them in memory and keep them in mind. But
did you say you're writing a book?
Yes, I am, right? So because I have a memory issue, so I need to put it on paper to not forget it. Okay.
I would read it.
Okay, good. So I have to, well, first I have to finish it because it's a lot of work. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, like we've been fortunate enough, we've been, I guess, talented enough, and like we've been working enough so that, yes, at some point our tools found the market. I was mentioning before, like if you sell that means that it's useful, right? If users don't pay for it, that means it's not useful. And for a very long time, they didn't pay for anything because they were telling us, well, it's not enough. It's not useful. It's missing this and that and this and that. It's complicated actually to sell a thing that, I mean, to have like a economic relationship with your customers and users that makes sense. And so if they keep coming, if they keep using it, if they keep like paying it, it means that there is something that is true and that is bringing value. So anyway, we've been to the point, yes, I would say in 2010, between 2011 and 12, there has been around 2012, there has been a change in the industry we've been benefiting from, which is the switch to PBR, physically based rendering. And basically everybody in the industry was like, okay, well, we need to redo our materials. And so they looked around and say, well, we don't want to use Photoshop anymore for this. We want to use something else that is more adapted. And we were like in the back, like waving our hands and they say, well, we're ready, we're here. Because like Substance Designer was already adapted to it because it was super easy to make it work with PBR workflow. And it was so advanced because for so many years we've been like pushing it. So it was very mature, even though nobody was using it. So it was already mature because we had been working on it for a long time before. And so basically, like the whole industry switched to Substance Designer at the time. And it's about the same time, like a couple of years after, that we introduced Substance Painter. Which was also like the big success we know now, and so both have been like huge successes, and it's been great to see. So for us to be noticed, actually we've been noticed by the whole by Adobe. You were mentioning Adobe. Actually, the whole industry noticed us because there was no market for texturing before, and then suddenly there was a market for texturing, and it's been significant enough so that when we got acquired, we were 140 people. So it's significant, right? So it's not something that is small enough. Like it was not anymore like two or me to only like you know, a few people in a cave, in a garage, and like first employees. But it was really a company. And actually, we've been approached not only by the industry, but also like by the trade market. Because in Europe, there were not that many businesses actually that were growing exponentially when it comes to number of users. And at the same time, in revenue, we were doing both of them. And so like it was pretty unique at a time, like when mid 2010s, to have a company like this, like growing, but with a healthy growth, in fact, not something that is like fueled by investors. And then you get the users for free or whatever. And then suddenly you try to monetize, right? We were really building a business that was growing exponentially, even though it was a healthy business from the mid-10, it was really doing well. And so we've been noticed by a lot of people, and so we've been approached by a lot of companies and whatnot. And we always wanted to keep growing. It was too good to not like keep doing it this way. And we had so much fun. And so first thing that happened is that I had to find a new investor. And so I had Adobe to enter like in 2016. So they were investors at first. So they knew us and they could follow us. Like, and they were part of the board. And so they've been like super helpful actually helping us like understand some business mechanics and making us grow. And in 2018, a lot of things happened and we ended up like joining because at some point, basically, what happened, it was, again, like the connection of many things. It was, and this is what I tried to convey in this Peter Jackson moment. So Peter Jackson moment, and I've been always a fan of Peter Jackson's. And from like early work, like, I don't know, Bad Taste and these crazy type of movies. And the way I wanted to explain it was, okay, Adobe, the same way Peter Jackson was like this guy doing this very niche genre, specific genre type of movies in New Zealand, like in lost area, very specific type of movies. And suddenly, like a big studio comes in and say, well, we'd like for you to direct Lord of the Rings, which is one of the biggest franchise and cultural totem in the world, right? So it was from like a very remote location, very niche type of things, to the biggest thing in the world, almost. And so to me, again, like not on the same scale at all, but to me, it felt like a little bit like when Adobe came to my door and said, well, Seb, we want to build this 3D division and we'd like for you and your team to drive it, right? So I felt a little bit like the same thing because I was on my remote location back from France, working on this very niche, specifically targeted and smallish thing that was texturing. And then they were telling me like, we want to go big in 3D overall. And with this big studio being Adobe, right? I was like, wow, okay, that's actually something. And it was the first time, and this is why we ended up like joining Adobe, because it was the first time that the project was so interesting. I could have like stopped here and done something else, but I'm still here, like working like my ass off, and like the whole team is still here, and we're all crazy and passionate, and we all like feel good about this and feel bad about that, and feel we need to invest here, and we're trying to find our way still. We're still the same team basically, and this is what we wanted. We all wanted this. We didn't want to say, okay, well, sleep on our laurels and go do something else. We've done like that with Substance. Now we're on a different mission. So this is why we're starting. We wrote one book with Amigo Rethme, literally. And now it's started book two. Being your own boss and suddenly being not the final boss is the most difficult thing for me personally. But really, when I think about it, like at Amigo Rethme, I didn't have to take like that many decisions by myself alone. So when I think about it here, I'm even a little bit in the same situation where really Adobe, there are not that many 3D specialists at Adobe. There are a few, of course, but my boss and the exec team, they trust me and they trust my team. And so when there's a question about 3D, usually they're asking us, what should we do? And so we're one of the fastest growing business lines at Adobe right now. It's small compared to Photoshop, obviously. But it's starting to be very significant and it's growing very fast. So it's, and everybody's agreeing on the fact that, yeah, 3D is the next big thing.
I have two related questions. One is if you can give some details apropos the latest developments in Substance. And then before we talk about the metaverse, maybe you can tease us with anything you can tell us of what you might have in the pipeline.
So there are a few things we've been trying to do. One is to make sure that the ecosystem of products is well connected, right? And well connected between each product, like between Sampler and Painter, between Designer and Stager, but also between like our own products and the rest of Adobe's products. So from Illustrator to Sampler, for instance, which is working incredibly well, from Painter to Photoshop and vice versa, and the kind of thing, right? And to Illustrator and to After Effects, etc. So also the source, like the library of our library of materials and assets now, environments, lightings, and meshes now, also being accessible through CC Desktop and also you can manage your library of content via Adobe Bridge, this kind of thing. So right, so we're connecting things together. Also, we're connecting things like by sometimes using some of the technologies, like some very advanced AI-based technologies that we can find in After Effects and Illustrator are now in Sampler, for instance. Also, we are connected with Adobe Research, which is incredibly amazing and like producing some of the best work and in 3D research in the world. And so we are slowly integrating that into our products. And so there are things that are coming. And if you look at the publications for SIGGRAPH, then you will get potentially the idea of what will end up in the products. Potentially, we'll see. But we. There has been these short videos by this guy, passionate about computer graphics research, about one paper that has been co-published by, I think it was Adobe Research from MIT, about retrieving some material information from an actual photograph, and but you retrieve a procedural a parametric material, like a substance designer type of material, from an actual photograph. This is amazing. So this is the type of things. Then something I can talk about, and next week we will announce something interesting to many people. Next week is GDC, by the way, finally GDC in real life here in San Francisco. That's very exciting. We will be announcing something around Substance Modeler. And Substance Modeler is this new tool for sculpting, like both in VR and on desktop, and going back and forth between the two and using the SIGGRAPH input or the mouse and keyboard input. And that tool, I mean, the team behind it is the team that was that did Oculus Medium at first. And that team also has been completed by people coming from Google, coming from Media Molecule, and many other places, and Microsoft, and it's an amazing team. And they're doing something that will really turn a lot of heads. So I'm very excited about this tool because I've never seen something so graceful. Like a tool that is so creative, that liberates people so much from technical constraints, and that still allows for very rich type of creativity. And it's amazing. So there is that. And then there is more, and I cannot talk about it, but we'll do an announcement soon, I guess. So no, it's pretty exciting.
What are your thoughts on the commerciality of software? I mean, how can software companies find that balance between making money and supporting creatives?
It's the crux of the issue. As I was saying at the beginning, if you sell, that means it's useful and it's making sense for everybody. If you don't sell, it doesn't make sense. Right. And so there is an issue somewhere. It can be the price, it can be the product, it can be like there is no need for your product. For a long time at Algorithmic, we could not find product market fit. And product market fit means, okay, we have something we have a product that actually is useful enough and is priced well enough so that people can pay for it to use it and feel good about it and keep paying. Because you can pay once and then could not never come back, and then it doesn't make sense either, because that means that you failed somehow, right? Or that there was not so much potential for the product itself to evolve, because it was like filling the gap for one thing specifically that doesn't need evolution itself, that doesn't need innovation. But if you're like in 3D, most things 3D, in fact, if you're in a position where the field needs constant innovation, we're not at a stage where it's very stable, right? It's not even a very stable stage, in fact, when you think about it, like you have this text editors, I thought I'd be paying for something like Sublime Text, for instance, right? I gladly pay for Sublime Text. And it's a text editor. it's not, you have free ones. You have like so many options. You can type text everywhere, but like Sublime for some reason has brought something that I gladly pay for myself. And so when you think about like, okay, well, there is text and then there's email and then there's, I mean, 3D is really at the top of like the pyramid when it comes to like the depth of innovation that you need, the lack of maturity of the field itself. Like it's evolving. It's evolving for everybody because we're very we're in the early innings still, right? Actually, I find finding a way to create a healthy economic relationship between a producer and a consumer to be very interesting. You know, and in our case, in the world of 3D, because it's so many dimensions, almost a form of art itself, right? It's an expression form almost. We could do our tools like for free, but yeah, I mean, like as a company, it's complicated to have like something for free. Adobe can have like free products, I guess, but not really. In fact, when you look carefully, And when I was at Allegorithmic, I can tell you, no, we would not have been able to have like this, all these people working on it and create this this healthy ecosystem if it was free. That being said, there is a space also for tools that can be free and even open source but the good thing about 3D is that it's in so much expansion right now that there is space for everybody. I, for one, like started pirating programs when I was a student. So I know like the value of free, like being able to try things, being able to like, try producing things. And then as soon as I could pay for it, I would pay for it. But before that, I could not, right? So I understand that there is a space for that as well. That being said, also what we're trying to do is we try to keep like our tools as much accessible like for students and because we know that. And so we try as much as we can here. We also have like the Steam versions that are accessible in like geographies that we don't like target very well at price points that are very well adapted to these geographies on like systems like Linux that we at Adobe is not very good at addressing, but we need to address. So we've been pushing new things here and there. So, I mean, there is space for everybody. It's in expansion. And also, I think even if it's not in expansion, there is space for all price points because there are many, many different type of users. And when you think about it, when you pay for something, when a professional especially pays for something, that means that there is a business relationship. There is some kind of a trust and a bond that is created. And this is we have to respect. And I like that because again, like when I see all these game developers like paying for our tools and producing like the most amazing art, they know that they can call us when they have an issue and we will be here because not only we're passionate, but also it's our job and we it's our day-to-day life. Right? And so it was a way for us to actually do that like on a daily basis and express it to the max and like keep like investing, keep innovating. And this is what we do, like really.
You're speaking to the core of the business. I mean, software development is closely connected with collaborating with the end users and supporting right. The creative community.
It's a very healthy and very simple form of ecosystem creation. It's super healthy. And the same way, I don't expect any artist to work for free. I don't expect engineers to work for free, right? So it's when I ask somebody to, when I have an idea and I want to express it, it requires usually a team, and not only me, of course, but like the whole team, when we have ideas, we put them in motion and everybody's finding its way in that because it's a healthy ecosystem and because it's flowing in both directions, right? And there is value creation.
Ever since the Renaissance, artists have been inspired by mathematical concepts and structures. And given your highly creative career path and background in computer science, what are your thoughts on the relationship between mathematics and art?
It's a big subject, right? But two things. Like one is some people consider that that two artists create their own tools, right? So tools are really part of the creative process. And if you indeed create your own tools, I mean, it's part of one of the ultimate form of art and creation. Of course, you don't have to because now you have like so many tools at your disposal. But like I remember this, like looking at the camera obscura, right? So what it brought to people as an artist as a tool was okay. Well, certainly you can do photorealistic renditions of scenery okay, it's a very tedious process, but at least you can it liberated some artists, but also it created some new concerns because everybody wanted that now, Right. And so it took time after the Camera Obscura was created to get to a point where you could have more different forms of art invented, because like some people wanted to like break free from this limitation. So the market was asking for a type of painting, and everybody was, so like the money was flowing towards these only. And so that became the only tool. And so that's the danger as well. So as soon as a tool becomes like, becomes the art almost, it becomes dangerous, because it kills like creativity somehow. So it creates the opposite effect. But if you keep creating your own tools and customizing your tools and like using them in different ways that were not like anticipated before, then you get to a point where it becomes healthy again. And when it comes to science, so science like and engineering can be part of the creation of the tools process. So that's one. And then it can be a source of inspiration or a source of co-creation almost. And inspiration has been like always there, right? Like we paint nature, and nature can be described somehow sometimes in mathematical and physical equations, and you can see patterns. And I've been working on fractals when I was a student myself. So if you start working on fractals and some physical laws, like how cracks appear on a wall, you realize, okay, well, if your cracks like divides, usually the angle is it's a 90 degrees angle. Usually there is no angles like this. What do you think about it? And when you start realizing these type of laws, you see them everywhere. You cannot unsee them. So that means that as soon as you start like seeing the patterns and using the patterns as inspiration, it becomes part of your work. And then I remember also starting like the creation of noise functions at the very beginning of algorithmic as well. One of my thesis was, if you ask someone by hand to draw points on a paper, we will always like randomly, we will very closely mimic Voronoi pattern because like naturally we try to place the points at reasonable distance from each other, right? So it's close enough to a Voronoi pattern in that respect, but it's not completely random. If you ask somebody to produce something completely random, we will fail, because we're bound to like trying to mimic some laws that we're identifying, or we are cabled in such a way that we produce this type of outputs without even noticing it. So you need the help then of computers, of programs to create these new patterns for you. So this is where science can then not only be an inspiration, but a co-creation. And then what we've seen lately with the advancements of machine learning is really, well, what can a machine learning algorithm produce for you or with you, right? And what can it learn from you or from other artists, and how can it help you create? And you've heard all these, we see all these hallucinations of like images or videos, but also there are some texts that have been produced, some are hilarious for now, but maybe they will become like amazingly good and like undiscernible from something that's been written by a human being. And also music has been created by pure AI. And so it's a fascinating world. And I always been interested in that. Actually, the term algorithmic, like the name algorithmic, it's that mix of allegoric, which is like more poetic and more artistic, and algorithmic. So it's algorithmic. So it's basically this mix of, okay, the poetry in algorithm and in math, and vice versa, the math in poetry or something like this.
Yeah, so you answered my next question, which was, if you see a direct line from scientists and artists like Leonardo da Vinci through to the sophisticated computer simulations we see today.
Yeah, absolutely. Any artist, especially with this type of artist, like would have embraced like technical advancements. I guess they would have been lost, like everybody's lost right now. I mean, it's so much information, but with their like a genius. They would have. I'm sure. I would bet they would have been interested in seeing what's available out there now, and like how can they transform that into something meaningful and art.
We have been seeing this gradual convergence between various industries, games, VR, cinema. These are partly driven by new technologies like real-time rendering, but also by the changing ways in which people are consuming media. Do you think that the lines between these industries will become increasingly more blurred?
Well, definitely we're already seeing like some cross-pollination, right? We're already seeing the use of real-time visualization engines or game engines even on set, like when you like shoot a scene from Mandalorian. We've seen these examples of like these virtual sets, and it's great because like the director sees the environment directly rendered in real time in the preview, and so it's easier to project yourself versus if you were to shoot that versus over a green screen, right? So it's bringing a lot to, but it's really this idea of a real-time rendering here that is key, and also not so much interactivity. So if you ask me, I see the convergence in some technical areas like real-time rendering, definitely, but not so much in terms of the type of media we will be producing. The same way there are still books and movies and music, there will be like movies and separated from interactive experiences. Like some directors will still want to just express themselves using a good old way of doing so, which is the movie or animation movie or animated feature. But also, and some others, completely different artists, potentially all the same ones, but most of the time, like completely different, will master this this idea of like, okay, what is an interactive experience? What is interactivity? And then there is this other layer, which is immersivity, which also same thing, like not everything will be immersive. Not at all. Like a lot of the content that we will keep like consuming will be on good old desktop or iPad, etc. We won't always wear these headsets, even like in 20 years from now. I mean, I shouldn't like try to predict the future, but I don't expect that to happen like anytime soon. Like us like wearing this headset all the time and being in interactive, immersive experiences and environments all the time. What I'm saying is that yes, it will happen, definitely. When is question mark first, but then if we don't wear that all the time, that means that all the other content and the other ways of expressing themselves for artists will still exist. You can still paint, you can still create collages, you can still create like fashion and express yourself in fashion and in drawings, in writing, in music, and they don't always converge. So yes, I mean, like what I think we're seeing as a convergence is mostly a convergence of some technological aspects, like a real-time rendering. Yes, it's not a game engine, real-time rendering. You don't need a game engine to do real-time rendering, in fact. That's what I'm saying, but you need the right tools to create, you need tools for creating all this type of content, which is great, by the way, because like these new forms will create new needs for content, will create new artists, will create new fields of expression. And I cannot wait to know who is the Stanley Kubrick or Peter Jackson of interactivity, of the metaverse, right? Who are going to be these new like incredible or Leonardo da Vinci, like to go back to our discussion again, who are going to be the genre defining artists that will transcend the medium itself, like to express something that like it's really a piece of art, right? And then it's completely outside of the realm of the technicalities. In fact, like for us, like in the work of in the world of the production and tools, we love to to look at the technical aspect of things. But really, like, if somebody is using a Substance tool to create music, fine, great, wonderful. Do that, please. That's amazing. And I didn't like anticipate that, but great, perfect. You see what I mean? So yeah, convergence, yes, to a point, like on some technical areas, but not like on the type of content.
You were mentioning the metaverse before. Do you have any initiatives specifically designed to develop the metaverse?
What people call the metaverse is many things first. So there is no one like super clear definition of it. But what I like to think about the meta, when I try to explain the metaverse is like the, Adobe sees that as the, when the web means meets games, meets social. And so this set of virtual spaces or virtual experiences that are 3D at their core, real time, and then potentially interactive and potentially immersive, but not necessarily, right? You could argue that the simplest form of the metaverse is actually going to the Amazon website and like seeing a 3D representation of an object. And it's a very simple interactive experience, but it's already a very useful one that translates to more sales, more trust in what you're buying. So it makes sense to a lot of people. So that's very simple metaverse, right? And so there is a need for that to happen already. So, and then at the very end of the spectrum, you also have like these very immersive, completely immersive experiences in which you have like a gigantic world you can explore and be completely virtual, in a very completely virtual environment and be something completely different and evolving. And then in between somewhere there is like the simulation and like a virtual industries, like representations of an office or a place where you build like cars. It can be everything. So that means that there'll be, so yeah, as Adobe, I can answer as Adobe, yes, we're interested in that, because that means that, back to what I was saying before, there will be a need for more 3D content. There will be a need for more people to get to that space and understand, okay, well, if I want to build my own website for my bags or for my shoes something that I create myself, I want people to experience them in 3D first. So I need to somehow convey that into, like, turn that into 3D representation. So we want to empower all these new creatives and all the existing creatives to create the sheer amount of content that we'll see required by that new space. It's a new dimension, it's a new space, potentially not so new actually, because like it's existing, like MMOs have been metaverses for the longest time, right? We know that. And so there's something in the game, from the game sphere, like if you come, like we come from the game space, we're like, okay, well, the metaverse guys, this is an MMO, this is exactly the same thing, right? Like but the thing is, everybody now has like it's the word is on all lips right now. So it means that all companies outside of games will want to create these immersive, potentially interactive, but 3D and real-time experiences, potentially on the web, potentially on different platforms. So that means that we as Adobe, we want to empower all these new creatives and provide the right tools for them. So soon, very, very soon, like as in tomorrow, we'll be talking about like getting into the metaverse. Like, what does that mean for Adobe? Will we be expressing, like, as Adobe, we'll be giving away some advice and views and yeah, we want to be one of the companies helping anyone willing to create for the metaverse to be ready. Right, that's the idea.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful interview.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.